This is a download from the Post-Keynesian Economic Study Group, PKSG. For more information and terms of use, please visit www.postkeynesian.net. Hello, my name's Mark Hayes, and it's my pleasure as Secretary of PKSG to welcome you to the Keynes Seminar at Robinson College, Cambridge. So tonight I'm very pleased to introduce Jeff Tiley, who is an economist in the Government Economic Service and with Her Majesty's Treasury, and who is the author of a book called The General Theory, The Rate of Interest, and Keynesian Economics, and with a very important subtitle, Keynes Betrayed. And I'm very pleased that he's been able to find time to come and talk to us tonight. I know that he has a very busy schedule, both official and domestic. And he's agreed to talk to us on the theme Keynes policy and the general theory, and this interleaves quite well with where we are in the text of the book, which is between book four and book five, you'll be pleased to hear.
Right.
So thank you very much, Jeff, and over to you.
Okay. So my work up till now has been mainly concerned with emphasising the monetary dimension of Keynes's theory and policies. My view is that it's been greatly neglected, plainly it's been greatly neglected, and that the Keynesians who argued that Keynes was exclusively concerned with fiscal policy have a great deal to answer for. But more recently I've become preoccupied by how this might be, how such nonsense essentially can have prevailed, especially because even quite a lot of post-Keynesians who do talk a lot about the monetary dimension of Keynes still haven't brought monetary policy considerations into the front place and seem pretty content with the Keynesians' interpretation of policy. Not all, but to a large extent. Recently, I think I've become increasingly aware of shortcomings in the general theory, and presumably discuss these quite a lot. And especially if the general theory is read out of context, and you know, given that the thing isn't read, so if it is read, it's pretty much bound to be read out of context, present company accepted. So I've been trying to think about various reasons. First one, methodology, I think. It's a vast step away from classical and neoclassical reasoning. If you look at the writings, you can see this as a problem in Keynes's time, but the problem must be even more acute now, given how steeped in the mathematical method modern economics has become. I mean, I just can't conceive what it must be like coming to the general theory if you've got that kind of a background, which I never had because I didn't do an undergraduate. Just came in a different way. I think as a matter of structure in the book, I find it off-putting because he starts with the labour market, whereas for me the sort of critical action in the general theory concerns saving and investment. So I wonder why he doesn't start with that. Then I think there's a number of omissions and incomplete expositions. The lack of monetary detail, a half-baked story on saving and investment, the incomplete and misleading analysis of the relation between liquidity preference as a theory of money as a store of value and the means of exchange considerations, the lack of a substantial discussion over short and long run and period considerations, which Mark picks me up on as well, the lack of an international dimension and theory, which seems to me particularly harmful, given that most of his policy preoccupations were in the international arena. And then lastly, the lack of a treatment of debt. Now, on all counts, I reckon we can absolve Keynes. He was writing a theory for discussion with his peers, and they were in context. He explicitly set aside policy. He was writing it as he discovered it, rather than sort of thinking through each discovery or innovation as he thought of them. It was rushed. I think he considered he had a mission to get this out. There was totalitarianism looming, and he wanted his policies to prevail. And I think, importantly, it wasn't intended to be his final word. But tragically, bar really only very few additional theoretical contributions and practical contributions that were largely behind closed doors, it was his final word. I mean, illness, the war, and then his death intervened. But it's my view that partly the loss of the policy perspective that's made these shortcomings particularly, has sort of exacerbated these shortcomings and allowed and has sort of made the recovery of Keynes, such as it is, to become such a mess. Let me give an example. The point of the theory of liquidity preference was how considerations of money as a store of value meant that the long-term rate of interest could be set by the monetary authorities. For me, in this way, it's the cornerstone of his theory. But the liquidity preference loanable funds debate, which I'm sure you're familiar with, seems to me to be conducted entirely oblivious to that conclusion. And as soon as you recognise the policy conclusion, the debate has a completely different order of importance, I think. And I think Keynes was right. You know, he did show, and it can be seen, that policymakers could set the long-term rate of interest if they chose. And the liquidity preference theory advised on how this should be done. I've written a paper about this in the Cambridge Journal of Economics. I'm not going to talk about it anymore here. And for me, loanable funds considerations are pretty trivial in this great scheme of things. So, my intention today was to give you my usual story about the reality of Keynes's policy initiatives. But in a sense, the reality of the economic environment has impinged on me. So I'm going to talk a lot about public spending initiatives, which goes against the grain a bit, because everyone does. But, you know, at the moment, there are a lot of stimulus packages being announced, and Keynes is being mainstreamed very slightly, more than he has been for a while. So I think it's worth doing. And it's also worth doing because I gave this presentation at the Treasury this morning. So it's on the shelf, and they asked me to talk about public spending, a small group of them. But I do think that in doing this work, in thinking about the public spending dimensions, which I haven't really before, I see sort of further explanations for the loss of the monetary dimension of Keynes's economics. And it strikes me that this is the sort of very rapidly changing environment within which Keynes was operating. So, you know, sort of environment was changing, and these were demanding shifts of perspective and policy emphasis that ran away from and perhaps even detracted from his theoretical discussion. I'm beginning to use a new characterisation, I use a characterisation of sort of cure v prevention, which are necessarily different. And I've got my new analogy about lung cancer. You know, you can prevent lung cancer by not smoking, but you can't cure it by giving up. So there's very different things, which maybe might come a bit clearer. But so anyway, I'm going to go through this. Section one will give you a bit of monetary background to set the context, and it's about prevention, really. The rest of it's about cure, and then I'll try and bring it together at the end. So we start with the gold standard, which was the backdrop to Keynes's work. This is a statement from a tract on monetary reform. I mean, my story today begins after the First World War, whereas I'm sure most of you know that countries came off the gold standard for the First World War, and then after the First World War, and the peace conferences at Versailles and things, they looked to restoring the gold standard as an explicit part, and they were setting up new conferences, and the move was to restore it. And Keynes said, no, this isn't a sensible idea. And the tract on monetary reform, I think, was a polemic against a return to the gold standard, not a return to the gold standard and overvalued parity or anything like that, against the gold standard per se. And, you know, he saw, in a sense, I suppose it's an obvious intuition that under the gold standard you'd have to take monetary policy action that would be inappropriate to domestic needs. But it was the background to everything, and in a sense it was the problem he gave himself to solve. I call it a project. Austin Robinson, this is from the obituary essay by Austin Robinson, which is, I don't know if you've read, but I recommend it. It's very excellent. But he talks about his main strategic objectives, and they are about, you know, international financial considerations, and then ultimately, as the last highlighted sentence says, you know, as a means to full employment, low interest rates, which is a sort of very different interpretation to what other people see. And I should add low long-term interest rates as well as short-term interest rates. This one's from A Treatise on Money. His Treatise on Money was basically his first attempt at a theoretical solution to his project, or the problem he'd identified. And up front in the treatise, page 15, he identified the problem of standard economic reasoning, which was they didn't take into account the true nature of money. As you probably know, he set out a theory in the treatise where inappropriate monetary policies led to unemployment, and the key mechanisms of the treaties were investment, saving, and then mechanisms based on divergences between natural and market rates of interest. It wasn't there. But it did take him to definite practical conclusions, which we'll come to. The other thing I'm struck with was that he was solving he was motivated by a different problem to the one of the general theory. He was looking specifically at the UK, looking at the poor unemployment performance in the 1920s, which followed the return to gold. He didn't have in mind a Great Depression, or at least when he started, he didn't have in mind a Great Depression. But of course, as he approaches publication, that's what happens. You get a Great Depression. It's published in October 1930. So I think the economic reality had just got more complicated, basically. And you had these two different experiences that these slides indicate. You have in Britain a pretty unpleasant 1920s, sort of 8% unemployment throughout, and then a jerk into a more severe situation, but up to about 16%. Whereas in the US, you have the sort of opposite experience. You have a nice boom in the 1920s with sort of 4% unemployment, but then this very extreme increase up to about 25%. So there were two different things going on. So I think that A, these events, but also the detailed critique of the treaties that was ongoing in the journals, demanded a return to the drawing board, which was the sort of genesis of the general theory. But, you know, while this was going on, the world was descending into the abyss, if you like. Policies were needed to help out. And Keynes was well positioned. You know, he sort of made his mark opposing this thing that turned out to not have worked very well, whether or not he'd got the Great Depression right. My key year is 1931. There's a bank rate chart here, which was a year of turmoil on international exchanges. And I think it was kicked off by a bank failing, Credit Anstalt, I think. What happened in July 1931, unemployment was terribly high. There was a sterling crisis, and the Bank of England found themselves forced to raise interest rates to defend sterling, as defend them a couple of times, which is sort of revealing the absurdity of the gold standard, in a sense. But then in September 1931, which is about here, I think, we came off the gold standard. We were taken off the gold standard. Keynes said, you know, we were freed from our golden fetters. Then, initially, policymakers put up interest rates a bit more. They thought that when we come off the gold standard, my God, you know, the world would collapse, so we'd better defend sterling with higher interest rates. And that was sort of the end of the gold standard policy, if you like. But at this point, Keynes seizes his opportunity and he sort of strong-arms his way into the front line of policymaking. And there's the policies come quite quickly. So in 1932, February, we finally start, interest rates start being cut. Then in April, the exchange equalisation account's instigated. I don't know if people know what that is. A new exchange mechanism for sterling, whereby the Bank of England managed the sterling exchange by buying and selling currency rather than by using interest rates. The Treasury voted them £150 million, which is about 50 billion quid these days, so the bank had 50 billion quid to fight against speculators. I've no idea whether that would be enough now. Then in June, the sort of final stage, they announced a conversion operation, which aims to convert the rate bonds that have 5% yield down to 3% to pull the long-term rate of interest down. And then they have this final rate of interest cut down to 2%, which is, of course, as you must have seen in 100 newspaper graphs, the rate that prevailed until 1951. So they were quantitative easing, as they say now. And you see that yield on consols, which is the long-term rate of interest in government bonds, falling, you know, sharply down to about 3%. It drifts up over the late, you know, over the mid-30s. When Keynes is ill, and I think he gets terribly cross when he sort of wakes up again and starts pushing them back down again. I should stress that Keynes saw these policies as permanent. You know, that was it. You know, this was the new design for monetary policy. It wasn't something to do so that we could then get back to business as usual. He wanted managed exchange, capital controls, which I didn't mention earlier, and low interest rates across the spectrum, and he saw that as permanent. So in a sense, they were his preventative measures implemented as part of the cure. So these two charts now show what happened. Unemployment in both countries, in this is US and UK again, unemployment in both countries only starts improving after they've come off the gold standard. So the UK comes off in 1931. I think the improvement in unemployment starts in 1933, and then the US comes off in 1933, and the improvement in unemployment starts in 1934. The point of these is because I want to talk about public spending. Did public spending cause the recovery? Well, it's difficult to tell because at the same time we'd had a sort of massive relaxation of monetary policy at the same time. So did public spending help? I mean, the answer, difficult to unravel. I mean, there's explicit testimony in the general theory that Keynes thinks monetary policy alone isn't enough and that fiscal policy is necessary too. But it's important context to evaluating what's going on with public expenditure. So, public expenditure. As I said, I think it's worth doing because of its prominence today. In a sense, it was a very different initiative to all the things he was discussing in the treatise. Although I think somewhere in the treatise he does advocate public spending, but I haven't time to look it up. I'll go through a number of contributions, but what's interesting in all the contributions is that there are these consistent themes that come up. Obviously, the multiplier, but the second of these is the most important: that spending will pay for itself. And I'm very struck today that people who are advocating public spending aren't advocating it this way. They aren't saying, "Hey, you'll spend it, it'll pay for itself. Don't worry about it." I haven't heard that argument at all. One last thing about this is that there's a sort of, I don't know how people view this argument. There's a sort of notion that there was this hard-fought battle between those who wanted to spend and those who didn't in the 30s. I'm not over convinced. It does seem to me that the key changes in the attitude to public spending came with political change rather than economic change. When we get when the national government come in, suddenly everything's up for grabs. We'll come to that in a sec. But in the meantime, over this period, they did develop quite a rich case for their use of public expenditure. So this is my chronology of, and we'll go back a little bit before where we started earlier, to 1929, to the discussions in the run-up to the 1929 election and the Liberal efforts to oust Stanley Baldwin, who was the Conservative Prime Minister. So we start with the Liberal Manifesto, Lloyd George's Liberal Manifesto, and he makes this bold claim, this claim that we've got some public works schemes and they're not going to add one penny to national or local taxation. So that's in the Liberal Manifesto. Keynes was involved with the Liberal Party, as I'm sure you know, and I think he was involved in the manifesto. I haven't done much research on that. But then he writes a series of articles called Can Lloyd George Do It? And he sets out a multiplier process in Can Lloyd George Do It, which I think is quite nice. I mean, Can Lloyd George Do It is excellent, actually. I mean, it's very rich in terms of theoretical insights. But he has this notion here of the multiplier process, you know, being the ABC of economic science. What else happens? The election. In May 1920, there was the general election. The electorate weren't won over by the Liberal Party's policies, but it was a hung parliament, so Stanley Baldwin was ousted, and a Labour-Liberal coalition takes power. I've got some pictures, I don't know where to show these to you, but it was for Treasury people. So Ramsay MacDonald becomes Prime Minister, and a fellow called Philip Snowden becomes Chancellor. There's a great quote about him. I don't know what it is. He was a true Gladstonian Chancellor. More rigid in his financial outlook than any Tory, I think someone said about him, but I can't find the quote. So they took over, basically. So they were in power. And they have a miserable time. You know, they've got that high unemployment. It's not really the best of times to be Prime Minister. But some important initiatives happen. They set up the Macmillan Committee on Finance and Industry, which is a very wide-ranging review of monetary policy and fiscal policy. And then also the Prime Minister announces his Economic Advisory Council, which is a body of the great and the good who advise over economic policy right through to 1939, I think. And Keynes is in the thick of both. I mean, there's this notion that, you know, really absurd notion in some textbooks that people only paid attention to Keynes after the Second World War, whereas really he was absolutely in the thick of it in the 1930s. Keynes has on the Macmillan Committee, he does both. I think he's a member of the committee and he's also a witness to the committee. And he sells to the committee his treatise theory, which is developing at the same time. And there's a particular encounter with this fellow called Sir Richard Hopkins, who later becomes the permanent secretary to the Treasury, and a lot of mutual respect between him and Keynes. But he challenged the Treasury view that Keynes felt he had to address is set out here. It's not didn't come up at the committee actually, but this is the one on this slide is, you know, the supply of capital being limited. It was undesirable to divert any appreciable proportion of the supply from normal trade channels, which is crowding out basically, then known as the Treasury view. Another one, which was from a budget speech that Keynes cites in Ken Lloyd's George Dewitt, orthodox Treasury dogma steadfastly held, blah, 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 that, you know, no permanent additional employment can, in fact, as a general rule, be created by state borrowing, state expenditure. So that's what he was fighting against. In fact, at the committee, I don't think Hopkins didn't take quite such a hard line, but that was the background. So we continue. So that was going to the Macmillan Committee. In the Economic Advisory Council is where the multiplier theory is coming out. Richard Kahn's on the Economic Advisory Council, and he circulates a primitive analysis of the multiplier. And then in June of the year, he publishes his multiplier article, The Relation of Home Investment to Unemployment. Another important article. This is just three points from it. Firstly, the point he's saying here in this article, I'm being scientific. We've all had the multiplier notion in mind. In this one, I'm going to show you how to solve it. I'm going to come up with a geometric progression that solves it. The second point, he notes that the intelligent cooperation of the banking system is taken for granted, i.e. it's financed by credit. And then he has this thing called Mr. Mead's relation, which is a sort of rudimentary or early attempt at trying to capture this notion that it's going to spend for it, it's going to pay for itself, not the final version of the sort of equation, if you like. But then in the background to all this is the monetary crisis that we were talking about earlier. I mean, when I read this, you get a real sense of events building up to a climax through this banking crisis. You get Keynes in March coming out in favour of tariffs, which caused a bit of a hoo-ha, especially upset the LSE economists. Then, of importance, is this May Committee report in May. I don't know if people have heard about this in July. I don't know if people have heard about this one, but the Chancellor employed or got an actuary, Sir George May, to do a review of what the economy needed. He published a report that said what the economy needed was expenditure cuts of 97 million, which is 36 billion, which, of course, while interest rates were going up, unemployment was high, and a very fragile Labour government were in power, and they wanted things cut like teachers' salaries, which threw the whole thing into turmoil. I suspect contributes to the destruction of the Labour government and the formation of the national government, which is when the leading ministers in the Labour government move over to the Conservatives and form a new government called the National Government, which then gets endorsed by the electorate in November, at which point Neville Chamberlain, this again from a Treasury friend, takes over as Chancellor. But it's also the point at which things really get going. As soon as the Lib Lab coalition moves out and the national government takes in, then we get the action, and then we get policies that start to move to solve the crisis. So within a month of the national government come in, the country goes off the gold standard. the case of public works is becoming increasingly prominent. There's a dialogue in the Economic Journal, a very nice dialogue in the Economic Journal. This warming publisher, Norwegian, I think, publishes an article. Kahn responds, and then this is very categorical: savings are always necessarily equal to investment. It's a mere truism. Whatever the investment funds are available to pay for it, so he's hardened his line, and that's a sort of getting towards the final form of the argument. Then in October 1932, there's a letter from Oxford and Cambridge economists, from Pigou and McGregor, I think, the Oxford guy, supporting public works. They hadn't written a letter before the national government came in, but they found their spurs in October 1932. And then, of course, Roosevelt takes office. I shan't show you his picture. And then we approach the World Economic Conference when Roosevelt's in. And Keynes' sort of manifesto for the World Economic Conference is the means to prosperity. Again, he concentrates on the sort of exchequer issues. You know, he notes that if you employ some people, you'll get some taxes and you'll save on the dole. Quite common sense. Again, I've not heard it said recently. So we're approaching the World Economic Conference, and it was a failure, as I'm sure you know. First, Roosevelt caused some dismay by taking the US off the gold standard just before the conference to, you know, reinforce the gold standard was started. And then I don't think he showed up to the conference, but right at the end he sent a telegram where he urged something better than the old fetishes of so-called international bankers. Keynes is terribly happy about this and celebrates in the Daily Mail the following day under the headline, "President Roosevelt is magnificently right." So things are opening up. And Keynes writes to Roosevelt on New Year's Eve of 1933, a famous letter. But primarily in the field of domestic policy, I put in the forefront, for the reasons given above, a large volume of loan expenditure under government auspices. So the case for public spending is now very prominent. Theory. I've not discussed the spending aspects of this much, but this seems to be the logical way to sell the theory. I'm grateful for suggestions. I'm struck that, you know, it was Kahn and others developing the theory, but Keynes is taking the general theory as the sort of final form. Should have been the final form, of course, because this is the form that most people are familiar with. He knows for certain the multiplier is not always 2. And I mean, there's nothing in the general theory that leads you to think that the marginal propensity to consume is a constant, absolutely nothing. Anyway, that's by the by. In the general theory, the multiplier comes from Keynes's law of consumption. Men are disposed, as a rule, on the average, to increase their consumption as their income increases, but not by as much as the increase in their... I mean, you know all this is on now. This is baby stuff. So you get an equation for the marginal propensity to consume. You take the national account's identity, you substitute it, and you get the multiplier equation. So that if the marginal propensity to consume is 3/4, the multiplier is 4. It's the same as the intuitive reasoning that I get a pound and I spend, you know, C of it, and then the next person spends C squared of it. So the two come to the same thing, which is nice. The other thing, apart from anything else, it's a closed economy, no government here, actually. It's an investment multiplier for Keynes. It's also a nominal relation. It's a cash relation. It doesn't tell us what's going to happen to output and employment. It just tells us what's going to happen to the cash relations. I'm sure you've done all this, so I'm going fast now. I'm sure you know that a lot of rubbish is talked about what Keynes says about prices. You know, this chapter 20 of the theory of prices. In general, output's associated with rising prices. If there's unemployment, you won't get much rising prices, but you'll get bottlenecks, and then you'll get true inflation. You know, it was all in there. So we move on to the financing of the spending, which is the heart of the matter. Don't use capital markets. Borrow from banks. And if you borrow from banks, do so at low interest. I mean, at the moment, that's by definition true, because the bank rate is very low. It has been pushed recently. There was a Charles Goodhart letter in the Financial Times on New Year's Eve, where he argued that the government should be borrowing from banks. So the argument's around there. But the major theoretical point that I'm sure you all know is that as employment increases, income increases, savings increase, then the savings can flow back into government bonds and repay the banks. So there isn't any crowding out. Keynes uses the national accounts algebra. You can do process analysis if you want. You can take the C, you can do the 1, the C squared. You can take the leftovers on the saving. You can add them up and that comes to 1, which is nice. But really, I think that, you know, the point about this is it's a monetary phenomenon. Saving isn't crowded out because credit exists. You can use credit and then you gradually create savings after the event. And that doesn't mean that the rate of interest must never go up if spending increases, but it won't if you understand these mechanisms and act on the mechanisms. And I'm sure Keynes would wholeheartedly support what Goodhart said. Government finances, again, obviously, you'll get tax from people who didn't have work. You'll save from the dole, you know, very trivially. I can make it work out if I use those ratios, but you know that. Then trade. Now, trade is, I've read Neil Ferguson, one of my least favourite practising historians. There was an article in the Financial Times a few days ago where he said that today's born-again Keynesians seem to have forgotten that their prescriptions of a deficit finance fiscal stimulus stood the best chance of working in a more or less closed economy. As is normal with a sort of declaration, there's no figures in the article. If I looked up the figures, if I take an average of the share of imports in GDP from 1928 to 1939, I get 23.4%. If I do it for the last 10 years, I get 26.7%. So, you know, we're talking 3% different, which isn't very vast. And it doesn't matter. You get leakages. I mean, that's the point of the multiplier equation, in a sense. You get one minus C is little s. It's a leakage to saving. And the M is a leakage overseas. It doesn't matter. I mean, I don't know if the reductio ad absurdum is to say that there's not actually any point in having any growth, because that would go overseas. But I don't believe it's a strong argument against the multiplier. There are other implications, of course. The multiplier process doesn't take account of what else happens. I mean, the idea is business optimism goes up. Hopefully business finances are a bit repaired. So, you know, the whole thing is sort of reinforcing in a very good way. Estimating it. One is struck, of course, that when they were coming up with these theories, there weren't any official statistics, or hardly any official statistics. I'm just about to have a paper published, actually, in the Review of Income and Wealth, arguing that it was, you know, very much Keynes's work that was helping to sort of foster the demand for national accounts statistics, and Keynes was right there pushing it. But at the time, people were relying on this fellow Colin Clark, who wrote this book, National Income, 1924-1931, which was published in 1932. And you get these various estimates. Kahn says 2, the employment multiplier is 2 in his paper, I think. Keynes, in The Means to Prosperity, sort of hedges his bet a bit. He starts off with 2, and then says, well, maybe 1.5 is a bit safer, and then he goes on about 1.3 as well. But then when he talks about the... Then he goes for the US in the general theory and has something between 3 and 2.5. Then Colin Clark, with some incredible precision, estimates, you know, 1.532 for 1937 and 2.92. But anyway, but they were the estimates that were kicking around. The point of doing all that is because we can do it now, because we do have national accounts figures. So these are my take. This is just del Y, del C over del Y in the blue, and del M over del Y for the pink. And I get figures. Well, I could contrive it and say that the C is about 2/3, M is about 1/3, which gives me a multiplier of about 1.5. And I can calculate the multiplier, and it is indeed a line that bounces around 1.5 with some volatility, obviously. And some slightly lower outturns recently, but I think 1.5 seems a reasonable guess insofar as it has any massive, massive use. But the other interesting thing about 1.5 is that it's Obama's multiplier. I don't know, I didn't get my prop, but I don't know if you've seen this, but the Council of Economic Advisers issued a paper about the multiplier, written or the CEO's chaired by Christina Romer. And then, as I say, they come with an estimate of 1.5. The paper's terribly depressing, the CEA paper, you know, for all the sort of alleged sophistication of academic economics. The analysis in the paper's trivial, you know. It just comes up with some figures in the appendix, doesn't mention anything about financing, doesn't have any discussion about prices. You know, it's not compelling at all. But nonetheless, there's a multiplier out there in the real world. And then there was a nice piece in the Financial Times a couple of weeks ago where the writer's alluding to sort of debate about the value of the multiplier. It's a debate that I've been completely unaware of for a long time. But he cites Barrow, who, of course, comes up with partial crowding out, the multiplier will be a lot less than one. I mean, Barrow misses the point, because the point is to avoid the crowding out, of course. But it's straight from his textbook, actually. I looked that up. And then Rogoff is saying that there's a wide range. If I look at the figures for the US, they've got slightly longer running national accounts than we have, actually. Crudely 0.7, 0.2, which gives me a multiplier of 2, a cash multiplier of 2. It's more stable than the UK one. It has these bizarre dips, but it looks like 2. And of course, we can argue about the price-volume split, but I don't think you can refer to a multiplier that you derived in the 70s to talk about what will happen now. You know, there are two uncertainties about this. The nominal one changes and the price-volume split will change. And I do find Barrow's position a very good example of how Keynesians have destroyed Keynes more than Barrow. You know, the Keynesians gave them the stable marginal propensity to consume. They didn't talk about prices. So really, Barrow's position is ultimately completely legitimate when he's confronted with the straight line on the graph. But there's much more to it than that. So, outcome, you know, going back, my Treasury presentation was entitled Did the New Deal Work? So we were, I looked at the national accounts figures for the time. As I've emphasised, there weren't national accounts figures at the time, so there are, I'm sure, are quality issues with these figures. G here, government spending, isn't equivalent to total government expenditure, because it hasn't got transfer payments in and things like that, but it should still be a good guide. What does it show? Cash levels in the first four columns and then changes on the year in the last four columns. Things that I'm struck by here in this green oval, it's the austerity prior to 1933. You know, very small increases for a couple of years. Then 1931, 32 and 33, really minuscule amounts of government spending. GDP actually, according to these figures, moves from negative territory very slightly in 1933 before the spending kicks in. But the spending kicks in 1934. But only marginally, that's 16 million, 4.4% of GDP, 5.6 billion now. But it increased, you know, throughout that decade, you see the intensity of the spending increasing. So by 36, we're on 1.25% of GDP. By 38, we're on 3% of GDP. And then by 1939, you know, we're getting up to 10% of GDP. So it's quite a big spend at that point, insofar as the data's reliable. There is a setback in 1938. There's a US recession in 1938, which I'm sure you're familiar with, which perhaps partly, and if you look at unemployment, go back to the unemployment chart, unemployment actually falls back in 1938. So that may have partly motivated the really big effort in 1939 as well. I put some volume figures up because I found could find them, but I don't trust these at all, because this has growth in 31 and 30, and this really phenomenal growth in 1932, which I suspect is a deflation issue. But who knows? But the absolute, you know, if you take away one thing today, I think this slide is of the greatest importance. This is a slide of government debt as a percentage of GDP. It's a Treasury slide. It's a slide, the data for which has been taken from the Treasury website. But what it seems to show to me is that what the Liberal Party and Keynes were claiming seems to have been borne out. So if you look at these figures, between 1929 and 1933, government debt is rising as a share of GDP, but as soon as the spending starts, the government debt starts to fall, and falls quite a lot. And this last quite large fall comes in 1939 with the big spend. So that it suggests that it was, as Lloyd George said, it wasn't a draw on the taxpayer. It couldn't keep pace with the war effort, so you do get this very large increase in debt as the war gets underway. But I am struck by how quickly the debt's brought back under control after the war, which I guess is due to the sort of maintenance of full employment. And I'm also struck, in fact, that the improvement in debt as a share of GDP ends in 1975, and really it's been pretty miserable, you know, ever since, you know, the free market's taken over, or liberalised finance has taken over. Government debt hasn't really budged. And the other thing, of course, is that there wasn't any crowding out. Long-term interest rates fell. Okay, they went up here, but they took action, they pulled them down again. Long-term interest rates remained at 3% through the whole of the war, the Second World War, massive borrowing. Some people call it the 3% war. And then they continued to fall right through to 1946. That line indicates Keynes's death, actually. And then they start drifting back up. I'll skip those two. So the US, I didn't research what the money was spent on in Britain. I gather it was mainly house building, but I haven't done much research, whereas this chap Peter Fearnan's book about the Great Depression gives me a lot more detail about what the Roosevelt administration spent the money on. So they spent it on roads, bridges, schools, 2.3 million public toilets, and various other things. But the important stuff here is the estimate. I mean, he estimates that between 33 and 40, they spent about 21 billion on public works. If you do the sum, that's 3 billion, that's 3% of GDP over the whole period, or 3% of GDP a year. That would amount to 420 billion a year in the US, or 42 billion in the UK. I think Obama's package is now coming in at about 800 billion, but I'm not sure if that's 1 year or 2 years or whatever. I'm not sure what to it's tax and spend. But anyway, it's a number that seems to be around this 3%. We'll come back to it. My same table for the US. Here I've just got levels for national income and government spending. And then I've got my columns of changes for all variables, it seems. Anyway, so here, GDP recovers in 1934, as I said earlier, which coincides with, again, with the start of the public spending. The 38 recession, it seems to coincide with or just follow a reining back of public spending. I think, and I'm not sure about this one, I think there was some veterans' pay that year. There was some bill that demanded veterans got paid their just deserts for the First World War, which limited or restricted the ability to do the public works, but I'm not entirely sure. But it was quite a sort of brutal turnaround for a year. On the debt figures, I'm not going to put my hand on my heart and say these figures are definitely correct, but I haven't got the source, so I'll dig out the source for the record later. But I think they're basically reliable. And it's a similar story. You get, as the economy goes into depression, you get a very large rise in the public debt. When the spending starts, the public debt, it doesn't fall in the US, but the increase in debt has certainly arrested. I think in 1938 it goes back up, and then we're into the war, of course, and it goes up. But again, it seems to be pretty reasonable evidence that the public spending didn't cause a massive increase in public debt. And again, you get the same story. After the war, it comes down quickly, get to the financial liberalisation, and the debt's back up. So, what conclusions do I draw? And did the New Deal work? It seems to me that spending patterns were pretty coincident with recovery, and certainly the reverse—that, you know, reversals in public spending or lack of public spending was connected with failure. Debt didn't increase, We shouldn't lose sight of the contributions of monetary policy and of the fact that the rate of interest wasn't pushed up, and it wasn't pushed up in the US either by this borrowing. In the general theory, Keynes, as I said earlier, Keynes does come to the considered view that you do need the monetary policy and the public spending to get out of the recession. But I think the other thing I'm struck by is that the New Deal spending wasn't colossal. I mean, I don't think 3% of GDP is a huge number. And the other thing about the figures, which I should have mentioned actually, Mark, I'm going to do this, is that these figures on the increases in government spending on this figure don't quite match up with that 20 billion estimate that I think that Fearnan comes up with on the previous slide. So he comes at 21 billion. I can't get 21 billion there. So I'm not quite sure, but I'm sure there are a lot of quality issues with national accounts around this time. I'm sure there's much more to research here. But the real action then, of course, comes with the war, because then you get this colossal increase in spending, no crowding out, and a very managed recovery of the debt after the war by the maintenance of high unemployment. So it does seem to me there is a validity. You can put a very strong argument for the validity of public expenditure there. I think Galbraith calls it affirmation by Mars. Just to give an idea of the new spending packages that have been announced recently, I mean, Australia announced one of $42 billion, which is 3.4% of their GDP. As I said, the US one, I've got $900 billion here, but it's about 6.4%. But again, I think it might be more than 1 year. And as I say, I don't know the tax spend split. China has announced a package worth, I think the figure I found was $585 billion, which is about 17.7% of their GDP. So that's a very serious fiscal stimulus. Again, I don't know. I think it might be over 2 years, and I don't know the tax. But that's a serious effort on their part. So, where do I go from here? We might talk about what I lost. I do find this public spending stuff incredibly diverting, doing this, and I think it has diverted from the true essence of Keynes. But I think we mustn't see that what I've just been talking about is the full extent of Keynes, because there isn't a complete theory of the economy in this discussion. There are some very powerful insights, and I think they're very encapsulated very well by this quote from Kindleberger that William Keegan cited the other week in the Observer. And I like the Keynes's own flight of fancy that I showed at the start of the presentation. You know, this basic notion that we can afford anything, we can do, basically. You know, to forget about the money. If we've got the people, we can do it, and the money comes along afterwards. And I think that, you know, it's a tremendously powerful notion. But that, apart from anything, but also that the discussion about the multiplier, I think, did open up a lot of lines of inquiry that would be very fruitful for the development of the general theory. But Keynes was connecting these developments to a wider theory of the economy, which for me remained fundamentally concerned with explaining why economies malfunctioned and how you prevented the malfunction. In the treatise, his story about economic failure was based on the operations of saving, investment, and the rate of interest. And I think that story remains central to the general theory, but in a greatly revised manner. Firstly, he takes savings out of the picture as determined by investment, as you see in the Kahn quotes. Then we have liquidity preference explaining the long-term rate of interest. And then we have this rate of interest in conjunction with the marginal efficiency of capital explaining the level of investment. And I'm sure you've done all this stuff in previous weeks. But there's no reason that the long-term rate of interest that prevails should permit sufficient investment for full employment. And I think Keynes also derived a cycle mechanism which was based on the rate of interest, investment, and the marginal efficiency of capital, which I in my book I extend to show how a boom coincides with the debt inflation and a bust is a sort of severe process of deleveraging. For Keynes, as I've said, to prevent economic failure, you should set the long-term rate of interest. You can and you should set the long-term rate of interest low. I've got a working paper on the PKSG website which discusses this. I think failing to act according to this prescription is the fundamental cause of today's economic decline. I usually show a slide which shows the movement of long-term rates of interest in the 20s, you know, sort of 5% falling down to about 3%, and then going up to about 5, 6% from 1980 onwards. And I think these long-term rates of interest movements are terribly important. In a sense, we've smoked. We've smoked for a very long time. We've now got lung cancer. And if we give up smoke, you know, we can give up smoking, but that's not going to be sufficient to get rid of the lung cancer. The patient's in pretty severe health, state of, you know, illness. A low rate of interest is necessary for its resolution, but I don't think it would be sufficient. In the first instance, we're actually a very long way from having a low rate of interest. This is my friend Graham Turner's chart. He's a guy who's got an economic consultancy called GFC Economics and written a book called The Credit Crunch. He focuses very strongly on corporate bond spreads, and what you see in the markets at the moment is that the interest rates that risky firms are paying for, you know, for borrowing are exorbitant. So, you know, while we've pushed interest rates down to about 1%, corporate bond rates ain't budging, or ain't budging a lot, and that's why people are talking about quantitative easing. So we need much more imaginative monetary action, much like in 1932, I suspect. And I do think that we need spending. And this 3% number that's kicking around seems like a good start. And the other thing, I think that I've brought a prop, the return of economic nationalism, the Economist tells us. But I think, you know, we probably do need the return of economic nationalism, or at least a good deal of economic nationalism. There's propaganda for me that protectionism either exacerbated the Great Depression, and I do think that needs tackling, because for me the Great Depression was caused by monetary failure. All I see in those unemployment statistics that we were looking earlier is, you know, a severe deterioration at the end of the gold standard, and recovery starting when we come off gold and spending beginning. I can't see how we can see in these unemployment statistics protectionism exacerbating the decline or inhibiting the recovery. I don't see how we're meant to be able to tell that protectionism's had a role in that. It seems to me a side issue detracting from the real forces governing decline and recovery. But I think we can understand alarm on the part of, you know, free marketeers as we're all beginning to discover that globalisation isn't what it was cracked up to be, and that national action is absolutely necessary. National action rather than market forces are necessary to recovery. There may still be a case for free trade, but I think it's certainly more complicated than the Economist would have us believe, and Keynes discusses this in the last chapter of his book, but I shan't read it out. I think the furore over economic nationalism is a good illustration of the wider nature of what's going on. And the previous slide here, we shouldn't be in any doubt that something very terrible is going on in the world economy at the moment. I mean, this US unemployment rate, I think, is staggering. I mean, it went up by 600,000. I think in 1 month alone. So so the world economy is in a terrible state. It's my view that the terrible state of the economy does have in roots the ignoring of the substance of Keynes's work. We've ignored him, and we've got what he did his work to try and prevent happening again. But I don't see any sign of any economists out there thinking that what's going on reflects a substantial failure of their economics. We talked about this earlier. I mean, I also see this sort of terrifying sight of monetarists crawling back out of the woodwork and seeing the current events as a vindication for their sort of perverse worldview. At the same time, economists may be advocating quite radical cures, and cures that didn't work, that don't work within their own theory, but they all see it as temporary. You know, they see a sort of most massive exogenous shock has hit the economy. You know, things will be back soon. They don't see it as some sort of endogenous process of debt. I've got an OECD paper, as an illustration. I've got an OECD paper which is looking to unwinding the measures that's been put in place to solve the economy. So they're already looking to, you know, the world afterwards, even when we haven't actually fixed it yet. And the same thing happened in the 1930s. I mean, Keynes called it the Society for the Preservation of Ancient Monuments. So the challenge for post-Keynesian economists, as I see it, is to get our view heard. I'd like us to agree at some point that the system failed because it's based on flawed theory. And I want post-Keynesians to argue that there is in Keynes's work a theory that remains relevant to understanding our predicament, that will aid in its resolution and will underpin the building of something more just and sustainable in the future.